Hi, everyone. My name is Dustin Elliott, and welcome back to another episode of the Y-Tune Podcast mini-series. Each week, I try and answer a simple but important question. How can we ask better questions to live better lives? Here on the YT Podcast Show, I answer that by bringing you dedicated episodes each week where I break down this concept into smaller, bite-sized, thought-provoking, tactical, and practical episodes designed to help you ask better questions, pulled from industry experts, science, philosophy, as well as my own tried-and-true techniques. I also find and interview a range of industry-leading professionals who all depend on asking good questions in order to achieve their work. From police detectives, journalists, scientists, medical professionals, and many more to glean the lessons and techniques they use to successfully do their jobs and to help us ask better questions. As always, I want to take a quick minute and thank the Y2 Podcast official sponsor, YZ. YZ is an easy-to-use online training software that makes it so simple to create and deliver online learning. Make sure if you haven't already, you jump over to their website. It's yz.com, that's W-Y-Z-E-D.com, to check out some videos and even get started with your own 14-day free trial. Also, if you like what you hear today on today's episode and you want to hear more, make sure if you haven't already, you subscribe to the YT Podcast, wherever you find your podcast episodes, so you don't miss out on new episodes as they come out. And if you haven't already and you love what you hear today, I'd love if you can leave a 5-star review. Make sure you jump over to the Y2 Podcast website at projecty2.com, where you can subscribe to our mailing list, find a range of additional resources and articles, as well as all the links to other episodes, just in case you missed them. With that being said, let's get to today's chat. Ainsley, welcome to the Y2 Podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Look, likewise. I remember when I first met you and you were talking a bit about what you did, and obviously we'll talk more about that in a moment. But I remember it was one of those moments in my life where, having been ex-recruitment, I like to think that I kind of know what people do. But I remember when I was chatting with you, I just went, "Oh, this sounds so exciting, but I have no idea what you do." obviously, I know we've had a few chats, but I'm really excited today to sort of drill down a little bit and to really explore, obviously, the topic of asking questions. So again, thank you so much for your time today.
No, you're welcome. And look, you're not alone. I think my family haven't known for the last 20 years what I actually do. So it's you're not alone. You're not alone.
Yeah, fair enough. It's got to make family dinners pretty interesting, eh?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, look, on that being said, though, I do, like I said, I do want to start there. Now, you kind of have two hats in today's conversation, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But I suppose just to start off with, I'd love if you can tell us a bit about what a qualitative researcher does and a bit about your career as a qualitative researcher.
Sure. I'll tell you what it is, and then I'll tell you a bit about me. So, an aptly named podcast, because basically we're all about understanding the why. So essentially, it's what motivates people, what influences them, what drives people to do what they do. So often we're dealing with emotions, we're dealing with subconscious behaviors or prejudices. And as a commercial researcher, so I'm not clinical, but there's always a commercial imperative to the questions or the why that I ask. It's really for companies to better understand their customers, what makes them tick, or their potential customers. So, you know, there's realms and realms now as more businesses are online. Lots of data about when people do things, how many they do it, how often they do it, how many times they do it, where they do it. And they're all really important, but the missing piece of that puzzle is why they do it. And that's where qualitative research comes in. It fills in that last gap, and that kind of brings you that, you know, holistic picture of a person. From my background, so this is a funny story. Qualitative researchers typically need a lot of empathy. So it's a reasonably female-dominated industry. However, the spelling of my first name is actually the male spelling of my name. So straight out of university, I loved all the, you know, behavioral development, the psychology that I did there, as well as the marketing subjects that I did. So unbeknownst to me, I was on the right track to kind of work in this space. So when I applied for my first job in this field, the company were looking to, you know, do something for the the industry and hire a male graduate. So of course I got shortlisted. I was the only female of the three that they spoke to, and lo and behold, I got it. So that started my career, really. And, you know, like to this day, even now I wear a co-founder as well as qualitative researcher hat, I don't think I could have found a profession or a job that suits me so innately. I was born curious. I was one of those kids that stared a lot at my surroundings and what was going on. So I think I've just kind of turned that into a commercial benefit, if you like.
Mm-hmm. I remember when I first reached out to you about it, your reaction was enthusiastic, but something to the effect of that you mentioned that you were always that kid that asked way too many questions in class kind of thing. So, yeah.
I always wanted to know why things worked. Why is that the case? So why has been a strong word in my history. And so I suppose I've worked here. I've worked in the UK. I've worked in projects that run through Europe and now in the US through Quali. So I've asked a lot of why in a lot of countries.
That's fantastic. Now, you did mention, and we will come back to a little bit at the moment, but you've sort of taken on a bit of a new hat in terms of the qualitative research. Just really quickly, can you just tell us what Quali is, just for a bit of context?
Yeah, so I'd say it's an insight platform, and we've sort of really taken the qualitative methodology and reinvented it for the future, fixed up some of the problems with it. So we're a video-based platform, and actually we facilitate participants in our projects to arrive at their consensus of why and why they think about things. So we've kind of put some automation and some efficiencies into how qualitative research is done.
Yeah, fantastic. I do want to have you on the full Y2 podcast, because I remember we did chat briefly about that, as my sort of inquisitive Y2 podcast brain is always on, and it's a really interesting story. But we'll come back to Quali a little bit later on today. But one of the first areas I do want to talk about, and we spoke about prior to today, was as a part of the qualitative research process, you're sitting down with a variety of individuals. You mentioned corporate, but you spoke about before that some of the more challenging aspects that you've gone through in your career was when you spent a stint interviewing a variety of patients, such as Hep C, meth users, terminal ill cancer patients, and people who are obviously not your typical, you're not obviously asking them about which brand they prefer kind of thing. You're dealing with people in a real challenging state of emotion. I suppose to start off with, when you're working in these types of situations, what are some of the most important things that you focused on yourself as a part of the process to make sure you can, you know, ascertain what you need to while dealing with this really challenging situations?
Yeah, look, I suppose building rapport, look, they are challenging, and also the other end of the spectrum is five-year-olds. But in any case, building rapport and trust is really important, and particularly with the patients who... particularly those who are drug users tend to be quite anxious people. So, you know, spending an hour with them, I might spend 25 minutes building rapport and building comfort with them. Whereas, you know, a straight up conversation about, you know, a TV campaign, it might take me 5 or 10 minutes. So it's really about, and also because like you said, we're not talking to them about a brand necessarily, but perhaps, you know, why they're not seeking treatment, or how they acquired what they've got, the journey they've been on so far. So some of those, they could be feeling guilt or shame or just grief. They could be kind of going through a grieving process if their diagnosis was recent. So it's about really treading softly. And I take a lot of cues from the space that I'm in, but also their body language. So if I'm going to a terminally ill person's home, you know, often you'll be looking at cues. Do they have a pet? Is there a pet bowl out? Is there pictures of pets, kids? You know, what's it, you know, maybe there's sort of, they follow a team sport or something. So you're looking for things where you can start to build a really comfortable, non-invasive bridge to them, essentially, because you want to make them feel at ease. You want to make them feel like you're interested in them, but not for any other reason other than they are fascinating, and their story is their story, and it's to be respected, but ultimately to be understood by me. So I suppose I'm looking at, so building rapport is the most important thing, really. And also being sensitive to where there are no-go areas. So you can see that immediately with their body language. They'll look away or shut down. So even where I sit with them, I might not sit opposite them. That can be kind of more confrontational. I might sit beside them on the couch. So they're all subtle, soft skills, I suppose, that beyond what you're trying to get through in terms of questions and asking them, there's a whole lot of other things happening. It's sort of like, you know, it's like the iceberg. Probably what you're saying is just the bit above the water, and there's all that other kind of work that you're processing simultaneously going underneath, like looking around the room, looking at their body language, what your body language is like. I suppose once they're at ease, then you can start to kind of mirror their energy. And if you want to get the best or the most out of them, I try and raise it a little bit to keep them kind of engaged in the process. So, but you've got to sort of see where they're up to and where they're at first, and get in first and build rapport before you can start to get the most out of them.
How would you go about raising the energy or mirroring that particular, how would you go about rather raising the energy? What sort of things would you do or say or try to act in order to do that?
I become more animated. So I talk a lot with my hands. And so I become more animated. I kind of sit up and lean in. So it's more around kind of my tone, my body language, the volume of my my conversation, I suppose, all kind of goes up. So we just kind of, I raise my energy, and often that will then be reflected back. You know, in other instances, I might be doing more commercial work, and I might be doing the second session of a night in my old world. You know, you start a session, people have worked all day at their job, they come and do a focus group, starts at 8:30, and they're buggered. You know, I'm tired too. If I carry that into the session, then they're just going to reflect that back to me. So if I carry in some energy, some appreciation of it being a long day, hey, we're all in this together. But if I lift myself, they will lift with me. Because funnily enough, ultimately people sort of want to please you a little bit. They kind of want to do the right thing for you. They're there to help you. And so they will respond to your energy.
Yeah. Two kind of questions from that, but on that one there, you know, we talk about this, that they want to please you kind of thing, but it's a challenge because you're sort of trying to reach sort of some objective truth, right? Independent of yourself as a researcher. So how do you go about trying to sort of steer them maybe towards what they actually think or feel, and a little bit less away from that sort of pleasing aspect that I think a lot of people just innately have? We want to make friends, right? How do you go about that process?
Yeah, we have our ways. So we call it a couple of ways. We have these things called projective techniques or enabling techniques, where essentially we're asking people to, you know, think about an issue or a brand or something that's the topic of discussion, and almost project. We get them to project their attitudes and their perceptions of that thing onto a third party or onto a third object. And so what that does often is reveal things that they wouldn't even know was there, subconscious, or reveals things that, you know, when they're gifts giving you lip service and saying how much they love X, Y, and Z, and then you kind of do one of these techniques, actually what's uncovered is not quite right. So I think the example that we talked to about last time was doing some work with GPs, and companies are always trying to understand how are they persuaded, like what persuades them in terms of writing that prescription over that prescription. And so I took these group of GPs on this wild guided visualization where I had them thinking about they were explorers in a jungle, and they were at the end of the kind of the treasure, if you like, was this prescription of this kind of product, but they had trials and tribulations to get there. They had things in the jungle that made things easier. They had things in the jungle that made things more difficult for them to get to this kind of treasure. And as I, so I get people to shut their eyes and I close my eyes too. And I walk them through this scenario and I don't tell them what they imagine. I ask them, you know, what's helping you on your journey? What's in your way? What's encouraging you to kind of keep going?
And is it like a story that you're kind of walking them through?
Yeah,
so I'm like, so like this, what happens next kind of thing.
Exactly. So, you know, yeah, think about what's in front of you. Okay. Now we've turned the corner. Now, what do you see? So you sort of give them a bit of guidance, but you don't tell them what they're seeing. Until finally you're getting to the treasure. Now, what is the last hurdle that's in front of you? And so anyway, open your eyes, tell me what you saw. Mm-hmm. And these GPs repeated to me that at the last hurdle, there was this temptress in the forest in a red dress with blonde hair. And turns out that was the sales rep. So of the competitive brand though, that was kind of this temptress trying to lead them away from describing this one brand over her brand. So I don't think any line of direct questioning, I mean, that came out, it was a bit of a joke, right? But if I had said to them, what do you think of the other sales rep? Are they influencing you? Is she a bit of hot stuff? And that's why you're a bit reluctant to not prescribe, you know, the one that you really want to. So that would never have come out with a direct line of question, but it's a fun way to kind of see what's going on in people's heads. And it's a non-threatening way. It's a bit of fun, but it's often very quite revealing.
Mm.
One of the other things which we do is a laddering technique. So often people are driven, we call it their highest emotional need. And often people are driven, you know, they don't go to the gym just because, you know, they want to get fit for summer. Mm. There's something else going on under there. And a classic but very lazy technique, which I was always taught to avoid, was the five whys.
Yes.
Ask someone, what is it about starting at the gym in winter? Oh, I want to look good for summer. Now, typically, someone would say why, then they'd be forced to respond, why, until you do it five times. And that's supposed to get you to the highest order need or the highest emotional need. The problem with that is, people, when you ask someone why, people latch for the first thing that hits their mind. And it might not be something emotional. It could be something very rational or functional, but it's the first thing that's popped into their mind. But then you ask them again. And so they've got to clutch at the next thing and again. And so they're actually just clutching at things in their mind rather than actually providing some space for them to reflect a bit, self-reflect, and actually explore what it is that's driving them to start at the gym. So, for instance, it might be, you know, why do you start to the gym in winter? I want to have a great body in summer. Okay, what's important about having a great body in summer? So just that subtle difference, what's important about that? Oh, I suppose, you know, it's nice to look good, you know, when I'm out and about in less clothing. Okay, what's important about that? I don't know, you might get to a point where this person is single, desperately wants a relationship. And so they're not going to get, you know, you're kind of inviting them to explore their own kind of emotional journey, if you like, rather than saying why. Oh, because my doctor told me I needed to. Why? Oh, because it's good for you. But why? Oh, because that's what you read in newspapers. So you can end up in a very different spot depending on how you probe people, if you like.
I love that idea. And I know to me, the five whys was always something, it was always a really pivotal thing, having sort of had been baptized in the self-improvement world and all that sort of stuff. It was really interesting. And I love that idea, because one thing that I've really believed is that a lot of the times we don't always necessarily know, or do we always don't want to sort of give up the real reason, the real motivating reason, because we're kind of maybe afraid of that. Yeah, you know, I want to look good naked. I want to look good with somebody else, you know, or I'm desperately single and I think this will help me. We don't always want to just completely come out and say that, but being able to sort of probe and be able to sort of drive through that strategically. But on that though, I do want to ask, you know, you mentioned, you know, taking that idea and then saying like, why is that important? Are there other sort of little mini cues or questions that you would ask or you would sort of lead with down that path?
It's always coming back to, so if that's what they've mentioned, it's more about, so what is important about that? Because they've said that for a reason. So what's important about having a fit body for the summer? Okay, so you look good in clothing. What's important about that? So I suppose I've just been trained never to ask why. Like, why is your absolute end question, really? So it probes could be what is important about that, or why do you, or it could even be you could project onto other people. So what's you know, why do you think society is like that? Where do you think that comes from? That's interesting. Tell me more about that. So there's lots of those kind of, those kinds of things. So that's interesting. Tell me about that. Yeah, those kinds of, I suppose, probes I use to try and get a little bit more. Also just silence. So if someone's talking and they're, if you're just silent, just gives them some space. And 10 seconds can feel like a long time silent, but often then they'll start talking again. So don't be afraid of silence, I suppose, when you're kind of interviewing or trying to understand someone, because they will fill the gap. You don't need to sometimes.
I'll try not to get up on silence. I was tempted to wait 10 seconds, but
it's hard, right?
I think that's important. And one thing that a previous guest mentioned, and it's something that I didn't really think about, but I've had a real benefit from, is obviously I've interviewed, you know, people for the podcast, and it's, you know, 1.5 to 2 hours of me asking questions and knowing it's going to be recorded. So wanting to not stuff up, but having that luxury to actually listen to yourself and actually be aware of how quick you jump into something. 10 seconds feels like a lot when you're in that awkward silence. So we might think we're waiting enough, but are we actually waiting enough and actually being able to be detached from that situation and listen to it? It's amazing how even myself, I thought I was waiting long enough, but I was really only like 3 seconds, which felt like a lifetime.
Yeah.
One thing I want to go back as well to, you know, as you sit down with people, I know from even having interviewed guests, sometimes they can kind of go directions which you see as not necessarily helping to answer the question. They're kind of going on a bit of a tangent. When you're sitting with people, how do you manage those situations when they start to go off on a tangent or they start going off in a direction that's not necessarily related to the information or question that you're trying to answer?
Yeah, look, I suppose it's about sort of shutting them down in a polite way.
Yeah.
The best way to do it. So it's saying things like, well, that sounds really interesting. Perhaps we can have a talk about it at the end, but what I want to bring you back to is X, Y, Z. Or that's a polite way to do it. Mm-hmm. Or you can say things like, well, I think you've earned your money today. Time to hear from someone else. That's a less polite way of doing it.
Just shut them completely down.
Yeah, but no, typically it's about acknowledging the story or the story they're about to embark on, giving them a chance to talk to you about it at the end, but saying what's going to really help me now is if you help me understand X, Y, Z. And so, because then that's how you tap into that people-pleasing nature in people. If you position it as like, give me a real hand and help me out with my job here, because I really need this answer, I really need to understand this, you know, I'll get in trouble otherwise. I'd actually use that technique with kids quite a lot, because they understand the dynamic of being in trouble if they don't do something, whether it's from a teacher or a parent. So I use that with kids to say, look, I'm going to get in real trouble if we can't focus and talk about this thing a little bit more. So yeah, so I either plead to help me out, or I'll say, that's really interesting, let's talk about that at the end, I want to come back to this over here.
It's really interesting you say that, because I recently interviewed a police officer, and that obviously having the challenge with a victim, not so much, there's still a level of, but they're more sort of innately wanting to help. But if you're sitting down with a persons of interest, I think is technically the correct term, and really trying to, again, adopt that idea that, look, this is just my job, or I'm going to get in trouble if I don't ask these questions, or sort of let me help you kind of thing. But trying to sort of align that, I think it's so interesting. You sort of talk about that within obviously a far less serious environment, but that idea coming up again. But one thing I want to ask as well too, is I suppose looking back on your career, I want to kind of open this up, because again, you're essentially a professional question asker. Are there other sort of tips or tricks or techniques and whatnot that you found to be really, really beneficial or helpful in terms of you know, helping you to do your job?
It's almost like before you start into meeting someone or a group of people, is to just wipe your thoughts away. Mm-hmm. And go in with the mindset of, I really want to understand this person's point of view and where they're coming from. I suppose it's it makes you less judgmental as a person, because some of the people who you meet visually for the first time, you think, wow, they seem like they've got it all together, for instance. And then you talk to them and you think, wow, they really don't, or wow, they've had a really tough life. So I think removing your prejudices, I think removing your thoughts, removing anything that's gone on in your day and your emotional state, kind of, you know, mute all that and going with what I call like a childlike mind, with that super inquisitive mind to, and not to assume therefore, so go in with a complete blank slate about that other person. It's one of the important things.
Do you have any tools or techniques or tricks that maybe you use, or cues that you'd use to sort of connect to that behavior, or maybe things you recommend to other people that they can use as, again, tricks or cues to sort of to create that state in their mind?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I have something that I go through so consciously before I do that. And possibly it's because I'm a naturally curious person. So often, you know, going to people's homes or speaking to them via webcam, like I'm looking at the background there and kind of
environment.
Drawing conclusions about you, Dustin. I don't think I go through any kind of processes myself necessarily. I suppose I just, because of being a commercial researcher, there's always an, you've always got an objective or an imperative. So I suppose making sure you really bed down, you know, maybe it's two or three key things that you need out of an hour with someone. So it's really intimately knowing them in your mind. So you're not relying on notes in front of you or anything as a crutch. So you just intimately understand what you need to get out of the conversation, so you can let it kind of run free a little bit, rather than being really militantly stuck to a series and an order of questions. So yeah, my advice to people to kind of is clear your mind as much as possible, but just keep those three key things that you're interested in understanding. And I think that therefore you can always come back to them in whichever way you see fit, would be my advice. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's fantastic. One thing I will kind of share in terms of my strategy for what's worth, because I think it's very similar to yours, is like we spoke about before, just prior to recording, I usually type up the questions beforehand, and I frequently follow up or send that to my guests, but it's usually with an apology that I apologize if this is incoherent dribble, because it's me really trying to understand in my mind what I want to kind of ask and some of the themes I want to explore. Yeah. So that to me is really, really important. And I do that all the time, even no matter what conversation. I try to think about in my mind, what do I need to achieve out of this for me to sort of walk away and go, yeah, cool. That was a tick, or I've sort of moved the needle, whatever that might be. And being open, I don't always achieve that. Sometimes I know I've gone into conversations going, I need to achieve this. But through the journey, you might realize that that objective isn't actually the proper objective, and it might help you kind of rein back in. But one thing I've tried to do is, well, naturally curious is something I would certainly also kind of listen to myself or kind of phrase myself. I have to admit as well, I'm also really bad for being a little bit too driven. I'm not tremendously patient myself. So sometimes I find that I can go, I've got my answer, let's move on kind of thing. And that childlike state is kind of removed. So I try to do like a mindfulness practice beforehand. I find that kind of actually forces me to kind of like calm down and kind of just like kind of put the brakes on and the momentum of the day and kind of put the brakes on and then kind of go again. So anyway. Nice. I suppose now I want to kind of shift gears a little bit, because you obviously, like I said, you're a qualitative researcher, but you're also an entrepreneur, co-founder of Quali. I'm really curious, as a qualitative researcher by trade, what was the process that you went about, you thought about in your mind as you thought about starting Quali? And I mean, to kind of a bit more on that, I mean, the Y2 podcast is really in its crux trying to find out what made people sort of jump the chasm from where they are to more of where they want to be. And it's a really interesting, but also a really challenging exercise to really go through and understand what you really want and why you want it. So I'm curious, from your sort of analytical mind, what was your sort of internal process or your questions you maybe asked yourself as you looked at, maybe I said, jumping the gap and starting Quali?
Yeah, look, it probably built momentum over a few years, really. Like, I love research, clearly. I love qualitative research. And I got to a point, I suppose, in my career where I thought, I really love this. I've worked in it for a long time. I can see some of the issues of it. And actually, historically, nothing really has changed about the methodology for 70 years. Mm-hmm. And so the questions I sort of asked myself was, well, how can I take something that I love and make it better, and make it better for what businesses need today, which is things quicker and things on tighter budgets, but no less rich. When we talk about qualitative research, we often talk about richness, because you really understand, you know, it's the depth or the thickness of the data as opposed to the breadth or the bigness of it, if you like. So I suppose the fundamental questions were, how can I take what I do now that I love so much, but make it better? And I suppose apply all of the things we've talked about in this podcast and other things that I've learned over the years. How do I apply all those same tricks and techniques and, building rapport skills and guided visualizations and all those sorts of things, and turn it into a more efficient process, but no less human? That was really critical. So it was, how do we take something that is really, that I think is really beautiful and really interesting, but give it the efficiencies, well, use efficiencies of the 21st century to kind of bring it up to speed a little bit. So, that was the beginning part of the process. So there was lots of tests, I suppose, early on with Rob, who's one of my other co-founders and also a researcher, was to say, can we still get the quality or the level of insight and understanding and emotional richness out of people if we're not physically there? So I'm not in your lounge room, you know, sitting next to you, having a chat and a cup of tea, but can I get that? Can we create that intimacy and that level of respect and rapport through online means? So, you know, we didn't unleash the MVP before we were confident that we could get the quality out of the process that we had produced. Essentially, we were the toughest audience to start with, really.
Was it, you mentioned that it was over a course of a couple of years, was it just that you sort of held those questions and you were kind of just constantly seeking for the answers for that? Or was it a deliberate, like, you and your co-founder, maybe you sat down and had that deliberate, like, I'm going to ask myself this question and try to answer it now? What was that sort of, how did those questions sort of come about?
Yeah, like, in fairness, I went very broad, and I'd probably had conversations with Rob, you know, stretching back 5 or 6 years, because we had worked together more than 10 years ago. So we had, you know, a friendly relationship. And so catching up with him and talking about what am I doing with my career, and this was years ago, and starting to feel that sense of, is this it? Is this all I'm going to be doing? Is this the end of this methodology for me? And that's what I sail off into the sunset. So it was probably sort of 5 or 6 years ago that I started to just to feel like it wasn't going to be enough. Like, I needed to do more with what I'd learned. And so I went very broad a couple of years ago when I started really investigating, or probably 3 years ago when I started really investigating where to next. And I cast the net broad. I thought, maybe I should go back and be a clinical, you know, researcher or a clinical psychologist and actually take some of this learning into a more, you know, purposeful space, perhaps. I was lacking a little bit of that. Is my research being used for good or bad? So I went really broad. Do I go back to university? Because I could apply my skills there. And through, or do I take it completely different direction and go into strategic planning and the advertising, you know, communications world? And then I found some people that worked in human-centered design and that kind of UX, CX kind of space more broadly. And I thought, hang on a minute, what they're doing is very similar to what I've been doing, what I've been doing for years. And so that's kind of where my interest started to peak a little bit. So it was at the same time that Rob actually came to me with the germ of this idea of quality to say, you know, we know this, we know there's issues with it. How about we, you know, try and crack away with it? So he actually had the original idea. And in parallel to the early stages of building quality, I did kind of moonlight in the UX space as a UX researcher, essentially. So I got a good feel for that industry. And, you know, if I wasn't doing quality, that could be the industry where I would be today, because there's so much overlap and parallel with just call different things, but we do the same techniques and the same sorts of, you know, the same sorts of inquisitive minds kind of work in that space. So, yeah, I suppose it took a few years for me to cast that net wide. And then it was kind of just fortuitous timing a little bit that the design industry in Australia was starting to kind of get some momentum. So it kind of pinged onto my radar. And also Rob came to me with this sort of the beginnings of this quali, crazy quali adventure. And so 2.5 years later, I've kind of wound up my consultancy work and full steam ahead on quali.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story. And I mean, I've had the opportunity to hear you speak a bit about quali in a few of our conversations. And like I said, it's I know there's a lot there. And I absolutely want to have you on the podcast to really dive into those moments. Because even as you talk about the, you know, casting the net wide kind of thing, I think that's a really important process that you went through in terms of just going, okay, is this it? Questioning where you are, putting the net out there, obviously probably having some hypothesis you want to start to test, potential answers, testing that, getting some feedback, and that process has sort of led you here. But I suppose on that, my last question for today, just to sort of wrap it up, but kind of taking a step back from all we've talked about today, do you have one favorite question or one technique that you you love to use or you find you use disproportionate in terms of your time?
It's an oldie but a goodie, but I can't. So I love personifications. I love them. So, and whether that's about a category. So the last one we did was around women who had varying degrees of affinity to drinking beer. Mm-hmm. And we asked them to bring to life the typical beer drinking woman. And it's so evocative what comes out of these kind of conversations. And then we also get them to usually match it with an image. So go online and find an image of this person you've just described. And often the imagery is far more powerful than what they say. They really just let rip on that. So that's probably a conversation for another time. Personification, although it's an oldie but a goodie, it's sort of if this brand or this category was going to be a person, what would they be like? And I find, because humans are really good, unfortunately, at judging other humans. And so therefore they're very good at personifying brands in a human kind of way. So I enjoy them the most because they're so evocative and so rich with what I can get out of it the other end. That would probably be, yeah, my favorite.
Fantastic. Ainsley, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insights today. Just for people listening, where can they get in contact with yourself and stay up to date with both your journey, but also quali's journey?
So you can find me at quali.com. And on the team page is probably a link to my LinkedIn profile. So people are happy to ping me there. No problem.
Fantastic. Ainsley, thanks so much again for your time. I appreciate it. And for everybody listening, make sure you stay tuned because there will be an Ainsley quali story coming soon. So stay tuned. But Ainsley, thanks again for your time.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. We'll chat again soon.
Sounds good.
Cheers.
Hey everyone, just before I head off, I want to take another quick moment and thank you very much for joining me for today's episode. As always, a big thank you to our sponsor, YZ. Don't forget to check them out for your own free 14-day trial. Remember, if you like this episode and you want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to the YT podcast wherever you find your podcasts so you don't miss out on any new episodes as they come out. And don't forget to leave a 5-star review if you haven't already. Really appreciate that. Also, make sure you check out our YouTube page if you want to watch many of these episodes online. And of course, you can jump over to the Y2 Podcast website. That's projecty2.com, projecty2.com, where you can subscribe to our mailing list to get weekly topical articles and resources and a range of additional content not released on the Y2 Podcast, all focused on helping you ask better questions to live a better life. And with that being said, I'll speak to you soon.